thought we could play this, now that we're no longer at war with Tennessee.
Well, yeah, but it'll just be a few months, and then right back at it.
It's darkness. It's actually this incredible CD by a guy named Joel Harrison, who's a major contributor to the original Nora Jones CD. You hear her sing. She sings on two cuts of his CD. The whole CD is amazing. It's kind of these weird jazz renderings of country stuff. It's a Merle Haggard song we might play a little bit later because it's appropriate to prisons and prisoners, and we are going to talk to Mary Werblin a little bit later today. She's a, you know, is great, and I would imagine. I've been trying to watch the 9/11 hearings today, although I was also trying to write a column and stuff like that, so I kind of had it on in the background. And it's, to tell you the truth, I've become completely addicted to it. Jamie Gorelick is definitely my favorite Beatle, but I'm just addicted to, as a matter of fact, I was so disappointed today, because when Louis Free was up there, Louis Free, very possibly, well, I think it would be hard to say that he was one of the most unappealing public officials ever to hold office, because there are so many candidates.
But, and the list just continues to grow.
Yeah.
All the time.
But it is sort of amazing that he was ever appointed FBI director. I mean, somebody actually looked at him and thought, geez, I want to meet with him every day. I want to have a lot of interface with Louis. Louis Free, I don't think this came up today, but Louis Free also is, like, famously a Luddite. One of the reasons that the FBI, you know, is less technologically sophisticated than, say, Eric and TJ, is that Louis Free was, like, just completely unfamiliar with computers. I don't believe in his entire time as FBI director, he either sent or opened an email. I believe he was unfamiliar.
How can you not do that? I'm like a dunce when it comes to computers, but even I...
You've got email.
Yeah. Even I know.
Listen, you've gone from that. You actually now, I think, download porn quite efficaciously.
Thank you very much.
Louis, he was just out of the technological loop. He just let that whole age wash over him. So, but anyway, he was up there. Janet Reno was up there. It's sort of like, it was sort of an I'll be seeing you kind of moment. I just, all these familiar faces kind of coming up on the screen. I'm thinking, oh, I wonder how Janet's doing. I'm thinking, the Parkinson's doesn't look like it's gotten that much worse or anything. It's just, you know. And she was actually a pretty engaging presence up there. But anyway, the hearings have gone on. I don't think that there have been any bombshells today. If there were, I missed them. Everybody, as a Christian Science Monitor observed, can point to any number of things that other people have done wrong. Almost nobody can think of anything that he or she himself has done wrong. And so that trend continues anyway. I want to talk a little bit more about, speaking of things to be proud of, our fine admissions program here in the state of Connecticut, which... It's clear to me now that, you know, people who for all of their lives have won awards for their moral probity and their, you know, highly refined sense of ethics and stuff like that, don't, when they list, you know, future occupations, say, emissions inspections. It just doesn't seem to be a field right now that's attracting the ethical cream of the crop. And I mean, today's article was especially hilarious because when they went out to get sort of an outside independent authority to sort of check on the way Agbar was running things here in the state of Connecticut, it turned out the only one that they could logically pick is another ethically compromised emission inspection company. So, you know, although it clearly is a debacle and a fiasco and a disaster and a travesty and a sham and a mockery here in Connecticut, it's also not clear that there's like some other shining paragon of emissions testing that we should have gone out and hired. So far, anyway, I haven't heard about it.
Maybe if the state just took it over itself.
Well, we sort of did that. I mean, I guess the EnviroTest was... I mean, it's...
Sort of did it, but yeah. I mean, just full-blown...
I'm thinking maybe the National Guard should run it or something.
Well, that might not be a bad idea. I'm sure they'd prefer to do that compared to some of the other things they've been asked to do recently.
Well, it's also, there's this weird sort of revolving sense of privatization. You know, they had sort of a single vendor EnviroTest thing for a while. Then they decided that they were going to really privatize it, contract it out to, you know, all these little garages and stuff like that. But under the supervision of the notable Agbar people. And now they're talking about if, in fact, things are as completely in free fall as they appear to be, getting out of the Agbar contract and then buying all of Agbar's equipment and sort of going back into the testing business. In other words, the state would wind up owning all of the equipment that Agbar has put in the state. So, I mean, it's like
This must be really cost efficient too, when you think about it.
Yeah, it's going to be incredibly expensive to be constantly cycling in and out of different modes of privatization and quasi-publicization.
How about home test kits? You know, everybody could do their own at home, and then you just bring the results in. Be kind of like the honesty program.
Well, what I wound up thinking, kind of semi-seriously, but this whole thing is kind of like the death rattle of a technology that probably is not going to exist too much longer anyway. I mean, we're spending millions of dollars trying to figure out how to test these cars, which we should, because they're significant polluters. But the truth is that if anybody had the courage to be honest with the American public, I mean, anybody in any position of authority, you'd have to sort of tell them, you know what, it almost doesn't matter, because in 5 or 6 years you're not going to be driving a car that runs exclusively on gas. I sort of do believe that. I was part of the morning reading a little bit more about this. And I do believe, I mean, there are a lot of books about this right now. There's one, the newest one is called Out of Gas by a guy named Goodstein, who I think is out of Stanford. But there's actually a term called Hubbard's Peak, which sounds like it actually might be located somewhere, but it's not. Hubbard's Peak, it refers to the moment at which we have exhausted 50% of the petroleum resources of this planet. And most people who study this kind of thing think that we've either hit it now or we're incredibly close to hitting it. Now, one of the interesting things about Hubbard's Peak is just because of the way these things work, and nobody, irrespective of political persuasion or ideology or anything, nobody who's familiar with this would dispute the next thing I'm going to say. Unfortunately, Hubbard's Peak isn't like sort of, 50 feet up and then 50 feet down. It's like 50 feet up and 2 feet down. Because the minute you hit Hubbard's Peak, what's happening to you then is that the shortages of petroleum and the demand for petroleum are both going to increase at the same time. So they're sort of pulling away from each other. I'm not explaining this very well, at an exponential rate. And so we're going to run out of petroleum really fast after this happens. I mean, we won't have like 100 years to run out of petroleum. We'll have like 5 or 6 years to run out of petroleum. And not only that, but the pressure to use petroleum in other ways is actually greater than it is to, say, burn it in things. I mean, to use it as a feedstock for so-called petroleum-based products, the economic pressure to use what little petroleum is left that way, may in fact exceed the economic pressure to use it to burn it in cars and stuff like that. So all I'm saying is, if you're buying a car anytime in the next year or so, buy at least a hybrid, and ideally a car that runs on, let's say, feathers or something. This is interesting. This is something that we're actually going to be talking about in just a second. But our new director just brought us a bulletin. We should probably mention what it is. You want to mention what it is?
I don't know if I'd call it a bulletin.
A bulletin. Is that a bulletin?
It's a flash.
A flash. A news flash. All right.
Well, it seems the Department of Corrections Commissioner and our fine Attorney General are going to be holding a news conference, and they'll be talking about whether or not the state can charge inmates for their incarceration. That's coming up supposedly at 4 o'clock, so sometime between 4 and 9 tonight, probably.
Yeah. That's an interesting statement, because, in fact, I mean, clearly the state can. At least there is a law under which people have been, not very many people, but a law which people have had their assets attached to cover the cost of their incarceration. Now, whether the state should do that is another question. I mean, it's a very stupid policy, and we might talk a little bit more about that later. But I just wanted to say that, really, it's funny. I mean, we're watching the emissions testing thing, and then a couple of weeks ago we had I-95 was on fire, and the cars couldn't go anywhere, and I just see this all as kind of a death rattle of a technology that's not going to exist anymore anyway. I really do believe that if, for example, John Kerry were in a position to be honest with the American voter, I don't think he is. I think we're such children, we're such petulant children, that we really can't be told the truth. We really can't be told about the Easter Bunny. And we can't be told about the fact that we're running out of petroleum.
Maybe the president will do it.
Yeah, and I mean, he's not going to do it. But you just think about all of the things that we do right now that have so much to do with our relationship with petroleum. And then think, I mean, even, I think anybody, from Buddy Vicevich to Ralph Nader, I think anybody would concede that some of our tortured relationship with the Middle East, I mean, we might all differ about the specifics, but I think anybody would concede that some of our tortured relationship with the Middle East would be vastly different. I'm not saying vastly better, but vastly different, if in fact they weren't big petroleum producers. and if we didn't need so much petroleum. You know, if we didn't need a lot of oil and they didn't make a lot of oil, I don't think we'd have anywhere near as much of a relationship. Now, would we have troops on the Arab Peninsula that are upsetting Osama bin Laden? I don't know. Maybe we wouldn't. You could point to about a dozen things that could be different if, in fact, we weren't so oil dependent. But in a weird way, I don't think it's going to matter. I don't think it's going to matter much past, 10 years from now. 10 years from now, I don't think it's going to matter because I don't think there are going to be significant amounts of oil anywhere at that point. Time right now for phone calls. If you want to call in, 522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC, star WTIC.
Talking when the cars are singing.
Oh, I'm sorry. And we have James in East Hartford.
James, hi.
How are you?
Good.
My opinion on the emissions, it's a fallacy to begin with. It's costing tremendous amounts of money. And between the car emission standard and the federal government, the $20 that we pay is a ripoff. It's a double taxation.
This is your opinion, man.
Do you think the emissions is really doing us a lot? What is it doing other than creating another agency?
Gives us something to do, you know, go and spend like half a day sitting around waiting to get that done.
Well, we sit around, we complain about how much money it costs.
Well, yeah.
And it's not creating any. What is it creating? What is it doing? The cars today, there are such stringent emissions tests that they don't pollute. So what is the emissions, what is this thing all about?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's true that emissions testing itself is a fallacy or there's no benefit as against the cost of emissions testing. Now, I'm not sure if you did a cost-benefit analysis of emissions testing, where you'd wind up. But cars do fail these tests. They are, in fact, emitting significant pollutants into the atmosphere.
What cars are failing the test?
Well, I mean,
the 15-year-old cars that are slowly disappearing anyway?
It's also possible for other cars that are in need, even newer cars that are in need of adjustment, to fail these tests. As I say, I don't think these tests are going to go on much longer because I don't think we're going to have gas-burning cars that much longer.
Well, I think hybrids are still ways away, and there is plenty of oil and gas. I mean, there's plenty. It's not been tapped into.
That's just your opinion, man.
Well, I mean, your opinion is we're going to run out in 10 years, so who's right?
Well, in fact, most of the geologists who are starting to study this stuff, and really there are 8 or 9 good books about this, I would commend to you, even just jump on the web and pull up on Amazon the summary of this Goodstein book, which is called Out of Gas, and then call back and see if you feel the same
way.
Well,
you know what? It proves my point then. If we're going to be out of gas in 10 years, then what the heck is this emissions thing all about? With the stringent emissions control that they're having right now, why are we going through this? Why are we spending millions of dollars? On something that just is a farce. It's a farce. It's another way of getting $20 out of everybody's pocket. It's another form of taxation. That's all it is. And if you're saying we're going to be out of oil and gas in 10 years and we're going to have hybrids, which, you know, that doesn't completely run on, it still needs some kind of fuel. Is it hydrogen fuel totally? I don't know. Some of these cars are using diesel. I don't know.
Well, let me back up and say that in 1999, the Legislative Program Review and Investigations Committee did commission a study of the efficacy, a scientific study of the efficacy of the emissions testing program, which I'm in the process of. I didn't know this was going to come up today, but and I'll try to share some of the findings of that when we get a moment here. It won't be in the next segment because we're going to talk to Tim Noah. Other than that, the other thing that I would say is right now we are in the midst of the most severe and terrifying rollback of clean air standards in general. I mean, national clean air standards that. Could have even been contemplated since the 1970s. I mean, what the Bush administration right now is doing is terrifying. And we are talking, I mean, we're not talking about cars right now so much as we're talking about power plants and stuff like that. But what they're doing with power plants is really, really scary. And in fact, they have essentially undone the work of all of the clean air legislation that was passed in the 1970s. And so this is probably not a good time to talk about reducing or cutting back on other kinds of emissions control. I mean, if you can get the Bush administration to stop doing what they're doing, I'd be willing to have a conversation with you about the efficacy of automotive testing here in Connecticut. But right now, we're moving so fast and so hard in the other direction nationally. And this is all about kids getting asthma. It's about adults with chronic bronchitis. This is about serious diseases for us and, more importantly, for our kids. And I don't think it's something we can talk about real casually.
How is it that
heavy rain falling seems like
you sing backup on this, don't you?
Yeah.
What do you mean backup?
I think this is Brooke Benz.
Jody, it's pouring rain, and we got a guy named Noah on the Saturday. So
that's very good.
Another dangerous combination. Joining us right now is Tim Noah, who writes many different features, but mainly the Chatterbox feature and the Whopper of the Week for Slate Magazine. He's with us now. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Pretty good. Now, are you as addicted as I am to the 9/11 Commission hearings?
You know, I actually have watched very, very few of them. How did Free do today?
Well, he didn't do badly, which in some ways, when you consider what a just generally unappealing national presence Louis Free really is.
He's kind of the fusion witness, because he's got both Fred Fielding and Jamie Gorelick hating his guts.
That's right. I kind of have a crush on Jamie Gorelick at this point. She's my favorite Beatle right now on the 9/11 Commission.
But, you know, the Clintonites hate him, the Bushies hate him, everybody hates Louis Free.
Is it what you've done in Washington? Are people sort of, every office you go by, is it on the TV set?
You know, not so much. I think that there's sort of kind of intermittent interest. There was sort of a fever pitch this weekend as we were all waiting for the August 6th memo to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was very obnoxious, on Easter Saturday. I kept running to my computer trying to get it, and we were at an Easter party, and I kept, reciting parts of the memo itself that had been from the White House to fellow guests. But that's, speaking personally, that was that's when my fever spiked.
And you really, obviously, were very interested in the August 6th memo, and there really is, I sometimes think the person who processes a lot of this stuff the best of all is Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, and he just sort of showed the clip of Ben Benisi saying to Condi Rice, and would you tell us the title of that memo?
I know. Well, it was just a little piece, little comic vignette in itself there. I can't hear you. Can you repeat that? What was that title again?
And then they just cut back to Jon Stewart, and he said, "You've got to be kidding me." Well, talk a little bit about the memo. You actually nominated it for your, or ordained it, or anointed it, your Whopper of the Week, right?
Right, because, Condi Rice testified on Thursday, and she knew that this thing was going to come out. She knew that it was going to be, that the way things were going, this thing was going to be declassified and made public, and yet she sort of brazenly went ahead anyway and insisted that the memo did not warn of attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, it did not warn of attacks inside the United States. It was historical information based on old reporting. There was no new threat information, and it did not, in fact, warn of any coming attacks inside the United States. That turned out to be quite obviously false when the memo came out. There was a certain amount of historical information in the memo, but it also said very plainly that there had been, allegations back to 1998 saying that Osama bin Laden wanted to hijack a U.S. aircraft. And it said, quote, nevertheless, FBI information since that time indicates a pattern of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijacking or other types of attacks. And so she just totally misrepresented what this memo said. Now, we can sort of argue back and forth about the degree to which we should blame the Bush administration for not acting on this memo, but to simply lie about what the memo said is crazy, it seems to me.
The one little aperçu that I think, even as we're talking now, is that all of these people work in the sort of the intelligence and security community. And that's all they ever do is lie. The idea that they wouldn't be forthright suddenly, in this particular context, they probably have almost no familiarity with actually giving anybody a straight answer about anything.
Well, I give the president credit, at least, because he did give a somewhat sort of ridiculous answer to this question himself a day later, where, he said, well, it didn't give specific information about sort of time and place, which a lot of people are now comparing to Clinton saying, it depends on what your definition of is.
Yeah.
But, at least he didn't lie. I mean, he spelled out the, somewhat ridiculous distinctions that he was making rather than trying to brazen it out the way Condi Rice did.
Well, I like the fact that he kind of represented it as, that he'd asked himself the really hard questions about his own role in this, and he
concluded that he was totally blameless.
But I do have to, I mean, I think there is a growing consensus that that it really is, the mind-boggling part of this is not that the White House failed to act, it's that the FBI failed to act because it had access to this information, and it had access to memos from the field saying, you know, there are guys on terrorist lists who are learning how to fly planes. And, you know, so I think... I didn't see it, but I imagine Free got something of a barbecuing over these matters this morning.
He did. I mean, he was asked hard questions. I mean, I didn't. I have to say, I didn't watch every moment of the testimony, but he did. He was asked hard questions. And but I think one of the things that's happening here, kind of at a sort of more macro level, is that, you know, there's a long history of stuff like this dating back to the Warren Report, and the Warren Report is as good an example as any of a situation where if you amass too much information, or enough information anyway, people can't process it anymore, or 20 different equally plausible, reliable scenarios can be constructed out of the same information. And I do think that rather than sort of one clear perception emerging from these hearings, it's increasingly the case that, you know, there's so many different perspectives. And you know, I mean, Louis Free basically, like everybody else, could think of about 20 other people who screwed up besides him, but not him. And I think unless a voice emerges from the panel from somewhere that really sort of penetrates the American consciousness in a special way, I don't think that this is really going to mean that much to people. And I think the one person actually who could play that role, oddly enough, is Thomas Kane, the chairman. I think you know, people look at Bob Kerry and stuff and they say, well, there's something kind of opportunistic about Bob Kerry even today, you know.
Well, you know, I don't know. Actually, whenever I look at Tom Kane, all I can think of is those commercials he used to do. You remember those? New Jersey and you, perfect together.
Well, that's the thing. He's such a schlub. I mean, you know, a lot of these people are kind of slick. Like, Ben Venisti is a very slick prosecutor and stuff. And you know, Kane, it's sort of weird. I mean, they went from Henry Kissinger, you know, a completely satanic war criminal, to this schlub who just seems like everybody else. And he increasingly is saying in his remarks to the press, you know what? I think this could have been prevented. I don't care what they say. I mean, the more you look at it, the more you think, yeah, we could have stopped this.
Well, I think that the greatest culpability here lies at the feet of the FBI. And, you know, there's clearly, it's very damning that the FBI Washington office had all this information and couldn't put two plus two together and come up with four. A number of people have written that what's really damning in terms of particularly Clark's book is not so much what the administration did before September 11th as what it did afterwards. Mm-hmm. You know, the most haunting sort of allegation in Clark's book is that the White House was desperate to use September 11th as an excuse to hit Iraq. Yeah, the quote from Don Rumsfeld saying, well, we haven't got any good targets in Afghanistan. We've got really good targets in Iraq, which sounds like something out of Catch-22.
Well, it also sounds like something out of Casablanca. You know, round up the usual suspects. Iraq, Iraq, and Iraq. I wish I thought that this whole process was going to lead to any kind of moment of clarity about all this stuff, but I don't. I mean, I agree, by the way, that, you know, there's a gigantic failure in the FBI, although big news. Actually, what was interesting about Free's testimony today was, you know, person after person would say, well, everybody knows how screwed up the FBI is, and then there was like a list, all the Wenho Lee stuff and the, you know, I mean, the moles and the, you know, just everything that had gone wrong over the last, and then Free would go, you know, I take exception to that. I mean, the FBI is actually a pretty good agency. And they would list a series of atrocities. And so, I mean, the fact that the FBI screwed this one up, too, in some ways isn't that big news. You know, I mean, they lose briefcases. They do all kinds of stuff. But I think, you know, the other thing that has emerged is that Iraq was an E-Day fixe or a bête noire or some French term for this administration pretty much around the time they found their parking spaces at the White House. And so they were too concerned with Iraq before 9/11, and they were too concerned with Iraq after 9/11, and they kind of never got it.
Right. I mean, you know, it's possible that, you know, it's starting to dawn on them now, but...
I don't think so.
Well,
the way the milk prices are going up, that could be just some leftover Iraq plot, you know? You never really know.
But, you know, it is troubling, the apparent determination, the over-eagerness to believe in connections that that were not evident then and don't remain, you know, remain unevident now. And, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who said, you know, it is really remarkable the difference in sort of standard of proof that the Bush administration applied on the one hand to the question of whether Al-Qaeda was prepared to attack the United States, and on the other hand, to the question of whether Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. You know, very different standards of proof.
Actually, according to Piney Rice, unless you can actually RSVP to the terrorist attack plans, there's no way of, you know, encoding what they are.
Right. Who knew what floor they were going to hit? Right,
exactly. They've got to tell us this kind of stuff, or what are we supposed to do? Tim Noah, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Actually, I think the person who's going to take the worst hammering over the next few days is in fact Attorney General John Ashcroft. The early indications in the New York Times and Washington Post both have stories today indicating that the overall report by the September 11th Commission will probably take him extensively to task as being, I guess there is actually a draft report already, or a series of draft reports that portray him as essentially uninterested in counterterrorism. And according to the New York Times thing, they also want to ask him some more questions about what he was doing about that. Remember the Gulfstream, like that $40 million Gulfstream he was flying around in? Because he stopped flying on commercial airlines sometime during the summer of 2001. They want to ask him a little bit more about that. Now, the FBI or the Justice Department's position on that has always been, well, it was because of some other threat to him. It didn't have anything to do with that, or, you know, something like that. It didn't have anything to do with September 11th, that it wasn't Al-Qaeda-driven. But that still bothers people. And there's this now increasingly, I mean, on a par almost with the August 6th presidential daily brief, there's this budget memo that people are going to start talking about, or are already starting to talk about. It is John Ashcroft's budget priorities. And he had 7 budget priorities, and none of them were terrorism. I guess there's a staff report that was released today talking about how the FBI failed over several years, not just on Ashcroft's watch, but elsewhere. They failed over several years to reorganize and respond to the steadily growing threat. Ashcroft rejected an appeal from the agency for more funding, the counterterrorism agency for more funding, on the day before Al-Qaeda struck. But most importantly, this report quotes FBI counterterrorism chief Dale Watson, former FBI counterterrorism chief, is saying he, quote, almost fell out of his chair, unquote, in the May 10th, 2001 budget memo from Ashcroft, listing 7 priorities, which included illegal drugs and gun violence, but not terrorism.
Anything in there about eliminating the Bill of Rights?
I think that's covered under one of the categories. I don't know which one. Creeping statues out there. Mm-hmm.
Right. Here is Sean in Manchester. Sean.
It's John.
John.
Hi, John.
How are you guys doing?
Oh.
I just want to congratulate you for having such an honest liberal on just a minute ago. He's talking about Bin Laden wanting to hijack an airplane, and he was going to hijack an airplane and do this and that. Of course, you never stated that in the memo. It said he wanted to do it because he wanted to win the release of the blind sheikh. Mm-hmm. And that happened in 1998. So, you know, if you're going to sit there and call people liars and dishonest, I think you need to be a little more forthcoming with the full information, not just split it so it fits what you guys believe.
I think you're the one who's splitting it right now, because I think that you know that memo says, since that time, the FBI has developed more information consistent with preparations for airline hijacking and stuff like that. It does not confine itself to the time of the blind sheikh.
No, but it says to release the blind sheikh, that's what they were thinking about. And did you hear Jim Reno today when they asked her about shaking the trees to get that guy in Washington? She said no, that was not the reason. It was because of an alert agent at the border.
Oh, no.
And then she said, and by the way, I don't remember meeting with the President of the United States.
Your misrepresenting what Jim Reno said. She said the exact opposite of what you just said.
That is a lie.
Okay, hold on. Let me just explain. What she said was, it was that border agent, she said, but that intelligence would have effectively been meaningless or not particularly useful if it hadn't been plugged into an operation that was already ongoing. And she said the real marvel of it was taking that incredible piece of police work that she talked about, that you're talking about, by that border agent, and plugging it into their ongoing operation that in fact was taking intelligence. In other words, to find that out would not have been helpful unless there was already intelligence without that.
Yes.
Yes. You're on the radio.
I wanted to say that PDB is not just a memo that's laid on the president's desk and he gets to read it. That is the outline of a briefing that he is given.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't the only thing he sees. Somebody presents that to him, of which that is an outline of. So each one of those points were further described to him.
Yeah, actually, with President Bush, what they also do is they put some of the points on a plate, and then like he eats his applesauce, he uncovers part of the. There's like a ducky saying, you know, that the FBI has not been able to corroborate certain things and stuff like that. So, and they've also, with these PDBs, they've tried decoupaging them onto shower curtains, which they then leave for him, you know, to use in the bathroom. But, you know, the guy who called up about this, I mean, he really was kind of misleading, particularly about the blind sheikh. I always feel like this blind sheikh is like, should be like a blues singer or something, you know. Blind Sheikh Umar Abdul Rahman, who's, you know, ain't nobody love me but my camel, and even he might be jiving or something. But anyway, yes, that was part of the memo. But the next thing in the memo is, nevertheless, FBI information since that time indicates patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparation for hijackings or other types of attacks. So it was not at all confined to the time of the blind sheikh.
Well, and that part of the memo was explained to him in more detail by somebody when that PDB was given to him. It wasn't like he took it out in the morning mail, read it, put it aside, and didn't think about it again because it didn't sound alarmist enough. That was the outline of a presentation given to him.
And the presentation was sponsored by the letters PDB. They had Big Bird come in and explain that to
him. Number four. And, of course, that song pertains to an internal investigation we're doing here at the station right now, but, which we can't really talk about, but it's Faith That's Hill. That's good, yeah.
It's Faith Hill, and I believe it's written by Beth Nielsen Chapman, some woman with three names like that. And as you recall, this is one of those Colin was right moments. Remember when I said I was going to cross over? Remember?
Was it that song?
It was that song. I said it was going to be that. Was gonna
oh,
be
yeah. Okay, yes, I do remember that.
And
yes,
Al Haney said I didn't know what I was talking about. You said I didn't know.
Oh, I don't know that I said that. Maybe I did.
Maybe you didn't. You usually back me up on this.
No, actually, I think with that one, I didn't.
Well, you usually back me up.
I usually do, yeah.
You usually got my back. We've got a time to do some open phones here. I want to talk a little bit about tomorrow's show. Today's show, we know nothing about it. We have historical information relating to today's
but
show.
But there was no plan.
There's no plan for today's show. Or at least such plan as we have has now been exhausted. Tomorrow, John Dean, you loved him in Watergate. You're going to love him even more now. Should be joining us. Hugh Blumenfeld, that long-haired radical socialist Jew, will be coming in here to play some music and probably get us in tons of trouble if history is any teacher. And one of, I can't even say it, one of our broadcasting
with a
heroes,
straight face.
Aaron Brown from CNN is going to be joining us at 5:40. How are we going to handle this?
What do you mean, how are we going to handle this?
Are we going to be...
Tell them what we really
hypocrites?
Think of?
I think we have no choice but to be hypocrites. Polite hypocrites.
Well, I think we have to be nice.
Tell them how much we enjoy his work. I think you should tell them how much you enjoy his work.
Yeah, right. I'll probably do that.
Anyway, that's tomorrow, so it sounds pretty exciting. Today, we've had a bunch of guests on. Now we'd like to talk to you guys if you want. Our numbers are 522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC, star WTIC. Interesting story in the paper today about how Mama Jo McKenzie, who's sort of one of the Svengalis behind the Roland throne.
Was she before or after Mama Cass?
Both, actually. But Mama Jo's 72, so she may not have been Mama Jo back in those days. I don't really know. But she's for about, for quite a few years now, I can't pull that number out of my head, 14 years maybe, she's been on the Republican National Committee. And, which doesn't sound like much, but it's actually a pretty significant and powerful gig for the right kind of person. She's being challenged this time, and there's a sense that she's vulnerable, partly because she's very, very much tied into the Rolands and all of their problems. Initially, last week, I believe on Thursday, Roland was, and these are people, described him as like a son and all this kind of stuff. I mean, these are people who have daily, intense interactions.
I can see where this is going.
Roland basically said, oh, she's on her own, I don't know, you know, whatever. Whatever she wants to do, that's fine with me. And when they were asked, he was asked whether he was going to support her, Well, subsequently, this kind of memo goes out, or this letter to possible supporters goes out saying, I hope you will join John Roland. And there's a P.S., I guess. So I hope you'll join Governor Roland and Representative Shays in supporting my candidacy and Mama Joe. I'm thinking, why would you want Roland to endorse you right now? I mean, you know, if she can also, you know, if she can snatch up that coveted Ted Bundy endorsement, too, I'm sure she can really hand the thing over to her challenger. I think Roland was probably trying to do her a favor by saying, you know, I really don't know her all that well. He was trying to help out a little bit, saying, frankly, I barely know the woman. She seems very nice, though. Whatever. Who cares? Don't call me. Anyway, our numbers are 522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC, *WTIC. I'm proud to say I didn't watch The Swan last night.
Good.
Yeah. Actually, instead, my son and I watched. This will seem like perhaps a strange movie to watch with your son for improving and instructional purposes. We watched Blow with Johnny Depp, which I feel like with kids, you kind of have to watch movies about drugs, particularly movies in which ultimately drugs don't work. Even if while they are working, they seem to be working really well and the good times are rolling, which is certainly the case in Blow. I think Blow is actually a pretty good movie. But, I mean, you know, you watch it all the way to the end, and then you say, you know, see? You think you're going to enjoy life as a big-time drug dealer, but look, you wind up as a loser in prison, you know, with a kid visiting you.
Here's Kathy in East Haddam. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Bruce and Colin. This is Kathy from East Haddam, and I enjoy your show a great deal, and it's the first time I've called you guys. You make me laugh practically every afternoon. Just a question for you both. Do you think that Governor Roland will be in the parade this Sunday for the UConn Huskies? I certainly hope he will not.
No, he will be. I mean, there's going to be a whole persons of interest section of the parade. You know, people who've been deposed and stuff like that. You know, they're going to have, like, in Spada's going to have his own special float, and he's going to be playing golf and
pulling over the other
floats. What type of reception do you think he'll receive?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing is it'll depend on what part of the parade route he's on. I wouldn't be surprised if Leo Canty is...
Give him an alternate parade route.
That's a good idea, actually. Let him go somewhere else. You can be in the parade, just not this one, okay?
Right down there, Columbus Boulevard. Yeah.
But, you know, is there going to be parts of the parade route where some of the union people and stuff are probably going to be there in maybe an organized way, you know, to let him, to make him squirm.
Right.
But, I mean, I think, you know, the truth is it's a day to celebrate the athletic accomplishments of... I mean, I always kind of wonder why anybody else is... I can see why there are marching bands in the parade. And, you know, sometimes we're in the parade. I mean, or like, you know, at minimum, some of, like, Joe Dea, he should be in the parade, Arnold and people like that. Yeah, right. And, you know, I mean, there's...
I just think that we're honoring, you know, two teams of basically made up of kids of honor and integrity. I'd hate to see him spoil the day for them.
Yeah, I don't think that'll happen, and I don't think the crowd will for the most part, do it. And hopefully they'll have him far enough away from the actual basketball players so that they won't think they're being booed for some reason.
Back and forth
but,
with shovel.
Yeah, but, you know, I actually sort of always wonder why there are so many people in... Like, I've been to a lot of these Husky parades, and a couple of years ago, they had me up in a helicopter. I was up in the State Police helicopter for half the parade, doing useless things up there. But, you know, there's, like, a lot of people, though. I mean, I don't really see why politicians of any particular stripe or hue need to be in this parade.
Right.
They don't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, it should not be a political day.
No, I would agree. But they will be. They will all be there.
Yeah, they always are, yeah. But I wonder how the crowd will react. It should be interesting.
Yeah. I think the House Select Committee should have its own float. You know, you know what? There's no press.
Depose a couple of witnesses.
Depose a couple of witnesses.
Yeah.
And not only that, but they're so far behind in their work, they could get a little bit accomplished during the parade.
Roland wants it in the open. This is the perfect opportunity. Depose the witnesses during the parade.
Yeah, sort of, you know, do a little float that's kind of based on the Judiciary Committee room, and they could do it there.
Yeah, I agree. And thanks a lot. And keep up the good work.
Thank you. Good work.
We must have done it at some point. It was an accident. All right, we got a lot of other calls here, and they all look very chicken good, and we're not going to go to any of them right now. But when we come back to this break,
no, because we're trying to be spiteful, we still don't have time.
We're going to have a few traffic and things like that. When we come back, we will talk to you about whatever it is you want to talk about. And keep in mind, Hugh Blumenfeld, Aaron Brown, John Dean tomorrow. It almost sounds like a radio show.
Huge.
Yeah. They play their game without shame, and who's to blame?
Oh, thank you, Sammy.
I
I thought I'd hear found a girl I could trust.
All right, we get some calls here, and I'll let you.
Yeah, sure you will.
You pick from among them.
Uh-huh.
Fine, contributor to the radio project.
All right, let's talk to Joel in a car. How's that?
Okay.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good.
I guess.
What is Bob Cox, the Clint Eastwood of weather forecasters, saying this for?
You better ask yourself the following question. Mr. Storm.
This is Bob Cox from the New England Weather Service. We've seen a number of locales already picking up an inch and a half to 2 inches of rainfall from this system. And we have more to go tonight. We do have some thunderstorms out there scattered about the state. We'll continue to see that threat tonight as well. But the whole mess should pretty much taper down to some scattered showers after midnight. Temperatures will be going up instead of down tonight, moving up into the 50s as the warm front passes through. That will also be accompanied by an increasing southeast wind. A flood watch is now in effect for the entire state. That will continue through the nighttime hours for southern Connecticut and into tomorrow evening for the northern half of the state. Wednesday, some lingering showers around, but mild. Highs in the 60s to near 70, cooler toward the shore. Right now it's 45 degrees in Hartford. More weather in 10 minutes on the weather station, WTIC, News Talk 1080.
Bonzi hit the 660th home run ball out into the waters of the bay, and steroids clinging to the ball caused several flounders to grow to the size of 800 pounds. It's time for Sports at 20, the very French sports discussion segment. Thank you, Mr. Ronald Dean, Mr. Bruce Stevens, and myself.
Louis Gascon de la Mer.
That triple double was like kids arrests and.
Well, no, that's not uncommon. No, that's not even a record
that's
anymore.
That's right, it would be a record.
We need quadruples.
Forget it.
Yeah, quadruples.
He can't really prove he had a plan to make a field goal, but he does have historical information about attempts to make a field goal. That's actually... I just went out. Atlanta's like 28-53 or something. Amazing anybody on that team.
I was in the break room just now, and Steve Salhaney, the operations manager of these four radio stations, and the first thing we all look up to tremendously came up to me, and he goes,
you know, I don't know. I think Bush is kind of... I think he's got some problems.
How perceptive.
He's unbelievable. Because to me, every day I look at the newspaper and the words just kind of blur in front of my eyes. I try to extract information that coalesces into an opinion out of it, but for the most part, I'm unsuccessful. He can look at these things, he can look at like four or five different stories and put them all together into the Bush has problems. That's the problem. Right now.
Some people just...
How does he do it?
Some people just have a gift.
That's why we're working for him. That's why we're working for him and not the other way around. Exactly. He's amazing. He's fascinating. All right, we do have some calls here.
Yeah, we do. Here's a Janet in Shelton. Hi, Janet.
Hello, how you doing?
Great.